Hello, and welcome to the Biotech 2050 podcast. Biotech 2050 is a think tank chronicling the disruptions changing the biotech industry over the next several decades. Check out our website at biotech2050.com or on your favorite podcast listening platform. I'm Rahul Chaturvedi, co-founder of this podcast and today's host. I'm also the founder and CEO of Clora. Clora is a tech platform that enables biotechs to augment their teams. Check us out at clora.com. I'm excited to welcome Scott McGaffin, CEO of Adiso Therapeutics. Great to have you on today, Scott. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Rahul. It's a pleasure. I'm a listener and an advocate, so it's a thrilling experience to be part of the podcast. Thank you for having me.
Yes, of course. And we're only as good as folks like you that are willing to join us, so certainly appreciate you as well. To kick us off, Scott, would love if you could talk to us about the arc of your career, how you got interested into biotech, and how you got to where you are today.
Yeah, absolutely. I started in the industry right out of college. And as a result, I often tell people I've never had a real job because I've gotten to do this my whole life. In saying that, I just feel that life sciences, specifically pharmaceuticals, biopharmaceuticals, is one of the most thrilling career choices I could have made. I'm a biologist by trade and apply that science knowledge, but I just enjoy the intersection with business so much. I came up through the commercial side, largely through Bristol-Myers Squibb, where I completed a majority of my career. And in doing that, I started in sales, moved into the Princeton area, and took on a role in operations, in managed care, in clinical, in training, and eventually into business management. And I look back on the foundation that I learned at BMS as highly informative, very beneficial for player developing a desire and an appetite to get into smaller companies. And that's where it's led me today. I've had experience in other companies as well, such as Pharmacia, Sherry Plow, Sepuan. But the time that I've spent in smaller companies over the last 12, 14 years has been the best time of my life. And I couldn't feel more fortunate to have followed this path.
And Scott, I'm curious, given your experience both in early stage biotechs as well as your days in big pharma, what are some of the lessons learned from your big pharma days that you can still apply now? And then second part of the question is, what have you had to rethink as it related to operating in a much more lean environment that biotechs traditionally have?
It's a great question because, you know, as I look back over my career, one of the things I'm most thankful for in my experience in places like BMS or Shearing Plow has been how they develop certain interdependencies and processes that are integral to their success. So different departments lean on one another. They understand the processes to the best of their ability of what the other component of the business may be doing. And I think that ability for me to be a part of that and learn from it, be it whether running a global marketing organization to where we wanted consistency across different therapies, down to adult learning principles, where adults definitely learn differently than adolescents. They learn differently than college students. But at the same time, when you understand those principles, you also understand what makes people most productive. And I think in my experience there, I look back on key individuals that I had a great opportunity to learn from, mentors along the way that took an interest in Scott McGaffin. And I think they did because I shared that I had an interest in helping us all succeed in a better way. I think that's been instrumental in helping me bridge them to smaller operations because I understand how bigger ones work. And I think that allows us to share commonality. And then in my companies over the last few years, I've really tried to instill that in my staff is we have to be respectful, not only of the way we need to work today and prioritize and get things done, but then also understand the priorities and complexities of bigger organizations and how they work and need to be efficient and get things done.
Yeah, that's a great point, Scott. Pulling on that thread a bit, just in terms of past experiences. So you've been CEO once before, this is your second time. Talk to us about how your approach perhaps to leadership or being CEO is different than the first time around, or if there's any, has your mental model changed at all from the first go around to this time that you can point to?
Yeah, it has changed. I think it's situationally different, depending on the challenges you're faced with and the macroeconomic challenges of the time. In my first CEO role, we were in a different macro environment, business environment at the time. And I had a wonderful board. I still do today, but it was a different experience. We had a single asset, very difficult indication, high-grade gliomas, glioblastoma specifically. In showing progress there in a very difficult-to-treat cancer is incrementally important. And one area where that became more important, as we've seen in other cancers, such as AML or pancreatic cancer, with segmenting the business and understanding the science behind that segmentation. We did an exceptional job. We worked globally on that. We worked with both the NCI in the U.S., as well as the EORTC, a large consortium of European countries, to run a very successful program for a certain mutation type of glioblastoma that turned out very fruitful. When we did, we went out to raise capital, and capital at that time was more freely available than it is today. And we got really good term sheets, really good responses to the raise. I took those to my board. And at the time, we had a more mature fund that we were operating in, which was one of the large supporters of our company. They sat back and said, wow, at these valuations, what could we do if we transacted the company? And I said, I don't know, let me find out. And within a period of about 18 weeks, we had term sheets from multiple companies to acquire us. And I think that was very meaningful then, but not really applicable now due to the macroeconomic environment that we're existing in. Not that we'd take challenge with that, but it's just different now. So I took those learnings, applied them now. And I think the thing I learned then versus now is that the 18-week equation doesn't really stack up. It's more of a patience game. It's a longer play. It's helping people understand that differentiation is important and why you're pursuing that differentiation is so meaningful. And as people deliberate and make investment decisions today, they just do so with a different set of lenses on.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that, Scott. We've seen more and more CEOs with commercial backgrounds leading biotechs recently, similar to you. I'm curious if you've noticed any difference, with neither being good or bad, obviously, but if you've noticed any difference in terms of how CEOs with commercial backgrounds end up operating and perhaps areas that they may focus on more compared to, let's say, founder-led biotechs or the scientist-led biotechs. And yeah, curious to hear your thoughts on the differences.
I don't know if one is better than another, but yeah, certainly different, right? And I think the optics that I bring, which is forward-looking, patients first, how can we make a differentiated benefit ring true to physicians who treat disease? That's really where I am, because I worked in the offices of physicians and worked with care providers, be it patient advocates or nurses or first practitioners over the years. And I really do understand the challenges that they face and the schedules they have that bring them to certain decisions on therapeutic choices for their patient. I'm not saying that's any different than a founder-led, you know, mindset, but it's certainly front of mind for me. And so as we make priority decisions here, I always think about ultimate implementation at the prescriber level. And that's how physicians really make their mind up on therapies that are going to benefit their patients. Is it by habit, which it may be? So how do you go about standing up, helping them choose differently? Or is it truly patient by patient and precision application of medications over time that are unique to that patient may will benefit? I think the latter has been more of an advancement in both oncology and now in immunology over the last 6 to 8 years than it was, say, 15 or 20 years ago when I was in a true commercial role. I think then it was brute force and opportunity to treat based on therapeutic outcome than it was today, which is tailoring the medication towards the patient themselves.
If you're an HR or hiring manager in biotech, you know all too well that the pool of experts seeking full-time employment is shrinking. Filling key full-time positions can be a long, drawn-out ordeal that can slow the pace of execution and growth. Throw away the old hiring playbook. Now you can build a biotech dream team in a fraction of that time. Find out how. Visit clora.com. Clora, talent optimized.
Wonderful, Scott. Now that I've peppered you with lots of questions on your background, and before we jump into talking about what you're working on now, I'd love if you could set the stage for us in terms of where the inflammation landscape currently lies, what's changed over the last few years, and then where do challenges and opportunities still lie that are worth pursuing?
I do think there's been an evolution. First, we saw it maybe a little bit more in oncology, and today we're seeing it evolve or emerge in immunology. And the way I often like to describe it in very simplistic terms is, for the most part today, inflammatory bowel disease is treated to the best of both the prescriber and the payer's ability to choose the right medication, but it's done so with kind of a large expectation of hope and benefit for the patient, not a real knowledge on how starting a certain therapy. There are gating mechanisms, there's standard of care, and then as patients advance or their disease advances, there's advanced cure options that might be available. But it's similar to treating an entire football stadium with a certain set of drugs, knowing that only 3 out of 10 sections of the stadium may have a positive outcome. What would be nice to know is, before you start that therapy, which 3 or 4 sections of the stadium patients may have the highest likelihood for a positive outcome. And I think that has changed the landscape for inflammatory bowel disease, or the promise of it going forward, in a very exciting way. We see activity in the space, I think led by Prometheus and Roivant, Pfizer, with TL1A leading the way as a potential marker for drug performance in certain sets of populations. We believe that there's even a greater opportunity at ADISA to do exactly that, and maybe do it in a non-invasive way, and bring forward a new medication that doesn't disrupt the immune system quite to the way that current therapies may. And so I often say, we're following no footsteps here at ADISA. We're blazing our own trail. And in order to do that, we need to be conscious of the way the landscape is evolving and how we might fit in the future. And thinking forward to do exactly that is what we bring to the table each day.
Great. And so, Scott, with that primer, talk to us about where you are from a development perspective today at ADISA.
So we've advanced an asset we call, by its numeric moniker, ADS-051, through phase 1B. And we're making preparations presently, after really good regulatory interactions here in the U.S., to begin a phase 2 in the near future. With that in mind, we are moving from what we see as very encouraging signals of activity, in addition to safety tolerability, which the phase 1B's primary endpoint was to do, into the next step of evolutionary drug development, which is confirming a dose, making sure we have the right level of medication to elicit the greatest response. And so we're pretty excited about where we find ourselves, and we look forward to taking those next steps with a great deal of enthusiasm.
Wonderful. And Scott, where are you now in terms of team building? How large is the team and what you're hoping to grow to over the next year or so?
Yeah, we have just under 20 people here at ADISA. We are very fortunate to have a highly skilled group of people in a number of different areas, from finance to strategy to medical and clinical ops. Amongst those people are some folks that worked with me in the past and some new people that I've gotten to meet over the last 2 years and work with that were already here at ADISA. So I feel exceptionally fortunate to get to work with the team. We share common values that keep our key stakeholders in mind. And we have front and center on our desks almost every day the idea that patients today may be fighting a battle with an inadequate supply of ammunition. And we want to bring forward additional ammunition to fight that battle with. And we think that ADS-051 offers that opportunity. So whether it's clinics or medical or finance or strategy or business development, it's a great group of people. I couldn't feel more proud to be amongst them.
And Scott, you know, on that point of the culture and the team aspect of it, when your approach is to blaze a new trail versus, let's say, having the benefit of relying on additional data or other people's failures, you end up having to hire folks that are phenotypically perhaps a bit different and have different risk tolerance. Curious how you think about what's the right phenotype to bring on to the ADISA team now, given the trailblazing nature of what you're doing.
Yeah, hiring is critical for any small company. So you do it very thoughtfully, and you think about opportunities that the business may provide, and then the application of the new person to help you broadly. You can't cover all bases with one person, but hopefully you hire with enough experience in those new individuals that they bring not only domain expertise specifically for the role they're going to fill, but they have a shared values or, to the best of your ability, a willingness to work across channels. I often like to say that I bring servant leadership to the organization. I don't say that to my team. I say it externally to people at the cocktail parties, in that I believe there's no task too small for the CEO to accept and undertake. I also believe that there's times when the CEO needs to be the boss. And that's not that common. I'm sure many of my peers feel the same way. But in doing that, that's the kind of people I want to hire. The people that understand in a small company, sometimes we're going into battle with a stick and a rock. We may not have the Spanish Armada behind us, but our willingness to accept the challenge and go forward and do our best to fulfill the opportunity is one that will. And you need a certain level of courage. And you alluded to this in your question. People need to feel comfortable working outside their comfort zone, right? They need to feel willing to say, I got it, raise their hand and move forward. Or say, I've done that before, and this was the experience we had at the time. These were some of the successes we experienced. But most importantly, these were some of the things we learned not to do. And help the rest of the team understand that repeating mistakes of the past, not always that fruitful. Whereas leveraging success and learning from some of the things we wouldn't want to do again is very beneficial to moving small companies forward. So it's looking for that person that can be the best position player available and willingness to cover other positions when they need to.
Yeah, said Scott. We talked a little bit earlier about how the capital environment right now is different than the last time you were leading a biotech. Curious to hear your thoughts on how it's different and how the current environment is informing how you operate at Adiso.
Yep. So this also dovetails off to what I mentioned and we discussed a few minutes ago. When you are truly differentiated, you like that as an organization, because everybody says they want differentiated assets to invest in. They want to invest in markets with high unmet need, but it also carries an extra burden, which proves that you need to help others feel comfortable in making that investment decision to undertake. And what I mean by that is you're asked in a not so general way, differentiated without doubt, unique approach that you're undertaking. People will acknowledge that, but they want to know, why are you in a small company like Adiso fortunate to come across this information? And why hasn't the big pharma done it already? And so it's what I call a knife that cuts both directions. On one hand, you love the fact that you're differentiated and you're going after something that nobody else has done. That's an admirable position to be in. On the other side, you have to carry that level of burden of proof to show that you're doing the right things and you've checked the boxes along the way to prove that. And so differentiation and blazing a new trail or following no footsteps is what I wake up in the morning and get excited about. I think the team does too, but we also recognize that we have an extra burden. So to the investment community, they're the current environment skeptical to the right degree. So we need to help them feel comfortable, not only with the information we have, but our decision-making capabilities going forward. Not only have we made informed or wise decisions today, but we're going to continue to do that. And we're going to look to them to help us based on all their learnings along the way. I think at times, your willingness to show that you've got the right team, you've got the right product, and you've got the right plan in place is what they evaluate by. But your willingness to work with them and help leverage and extract their knowledge, because they see things at a whole different altitude than what we do. They may not have the depth of it that we do, but I think that helps them make more challenging investment decisions. And that's what we're attempting to do now as we're heading into our B series. But at the same time, I think it also resonates well with those investment firms that they're investing not only the right product and the right company, but the right people who will work with them as collaborators going forward.
And Scott, we talked a little bit earlier about how Adiso came out of Morningside and that ecosystem. In the 2 years that you've now been at, 2 years and change that you've now been at Adiso, what's it like been working in that ecosystem? Because there's a lot of venture folks now that are incubating companies and have 10, 20 different companies that they're incubating at a given time. Here's what your approach has been and what are some of the advantages of operating in that sort of ecosystem?
Yeah, I'd say that the advantages are numerous. The few that I'd point to specifically is what we've been discussing, which is these differentiated assets. At least where we sit at Adiso today, the Morningside team, along with my predecessor, really looked for good science to collaborate with. So although they collaborated with institutions like the University of Massachusetts Chan Medical Center and the Hudson Institute in Melbourne, Australia, and the University of County Cork, they did so globally. And they did so in a business sense that allowed the investigators or the researchers in those institutions to share their knowledge collaboratively, and they gave them a stake in this business. And for that, we are tremendously thankful for the hard work they've done. But we haven't stopped there. We've worked with other institutions around the world in a very collaborative way as well. So one of the things that I feel most proud of and thankful for is our work with the University of Edinburgh's Center for Inflammation Research. There's some investigators there that are helping us learn things about our assets that even our founders find impressive. And I think that level of collaboration begun by Morningside and carried forward by our team here at Adiso today has allowed us to really stand apart. And I think that's going to make a real difference in our development program going forward. I think it's already been recognized by the regulatory authorities and the feedback that we've received from them. But I believe going forward, the plan is to continue to collaborate, potentially with large strategics along the way as well, in how do we make these drugs everything they can be for the benefit of patients. And it all began with Morningside, and it began with Gerald Chan. And I'm so thankful for that opportunity. It's been carried forward by Jason Dingus and Isaac Chang, who are board members, and I think that spirit has allowed Adiso to really stand alone on in inflammation research in the way we are.
And you mentioned partnering potentially with strategics or big pharma. Walk us through how you think about what's the best way to potentially for biotechs to partner with big pharma and just the decision-making framework you tend to use about whether it's the right time to partner and who to partner with.
That's a great question. And I think this is where my big pharma experience lends itself of some usefulness. I do have empathy for search and evaluation teams within big pharma today, largely due to what we discussed a moment ago, which is the macroeconomic environment that we're existing in. They are swamped with opportunities, and it's largely due to the funding environment, things like that, but also their ability to sift through different alternatives and investment partnership opportunities from company to company is truly impressive for me. So I think that's where in the discussions that I either lead or I'm a heavy part of with potential strategic partners, we bring forward that appreciation. And we try and first seek to understand what their priorities are, where they're looking to plug things in and how they feel Adiso may be able to help them accomplish their objectives. But then two, value the success that they've had either through strategic alliances or intercompany development programs of their own. And there is a tremendous amount that I think small companies can leverage, whether or not it's implementable or we need their hands in the development program or strictly just their knowledge, I think is one that small companies can benefit from tremendously because of the size and reach and effort that large strategics have, and then how they've learned over time. Some of the things we'd never know from the outside looking in, but they understand immunology, they understand inflammation, and we respect that and look to learn from it. So I think all those things combined, along with very busy schedules and then helping them both present and represent internally what we share with them from Adiso's standpoint. Because eventually, you're interacting with a small number of people on the other side of the table. They then need to represent you as you within their organizations. And we understand that. And we try and arm them to the best of their ability to make sure that people understand what our assets represent, how they're differentiated, and how they may help them accomplish what they need to do.
That's a great point about fostering those relationships. So you have internal champions within these pharma companies that you're trying to partner with. That's a great point. Scott, before we let you run, and I've asked you to reflect quite a bit, but one last time, what's one piece of advice that you wish you could provide your younger self, knowing all that you now know and all that you've experienced?
I say this to myself frequently. You experience life as you live it. You appreciate life when you look back on it. And I'm just full of appreciation for the many mentors and supervisors that I've had. People like Jack Carmody, Wayne Howe, Mike Dougherty, Frank Baldino, Ramesh Kumar, Dennis Podolzak. People like that that have taken a real interest in me. And at the time, we were struggling to come up with better answers. And I remember how difficult, challenging that was. How waking up at 2 a.m. wasn't much fun. But looking back on the successes we've had and the fact that we focused on those together, and I really tried to listen to the wisdom that was shared with me by those mentors, just means the world to me today. And I guess if I was talking to my younger self today, I'd say, be a little more patient. Don't feel like you need to know it all immediately. Allow this to flow over you to some degree, but keep persistency in the front of your mind and don't allow that not to be for your benefit. It's been a tremendous opportunity. I think there were times, you know, in my early career where I was a little anxious about what might be going on at the moment, but there's a saying that, you know, tough times never last, tough people do. And you have to be a little bit tough in our industry. And so I go back to where I started. I've never had a real job. I've gotten to do this all my life. And I'm so thankful for that. And I think looking back on it is when I appreciate it. Sometimes there were some tough days that I didn't appreciate that much on those days, but boy, I sure do today. And I think a little bit of patience back in those tough times would have allowed me to be even more successful when I've been. And I feel like I owe a lot to the people that helped me get there.
On that salient point, Scott, it was a pleasure having you on. Thanks for sharing a bit about your background and the exciting work that you and your colleagues are pursuing at Adiso.
Thank you, Raul. And again, I'm a big fan and a listener. I don't know if I'll listen to this episode, but I do look forward to future bio podcasts. And I look forward to what we're going to all experience by the time 2050 rolls around. Thank you.
Thank you, Scott. Appreciate the support.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Biotech 2050. This episode is hosted by me, Rahul Chaturvedi, and Alok Tai. If you enjoyed this episode of Biotech 2050, please subscribe to our podcast and leave us a review. Also follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Biotech2050Pod. Again, that's Biotech2050Pod. Until next time.